This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, a look at the FDA decision about eating meat from cloned animals. But first, cosmology. Or maybe more accurately, cosmology with a dash of philosophy. When will the end of science come? With our massive telescopes, we've peered further back in time than Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein would ever have imagined. Our understanding of the universe has shifted again and again in the last century. And it seems we are closer than ever, well, perhaps a few super collider experiments away from understanding more about how the universe is put together. Are we reaching the end of what we can know, the end of science? On the other hand, we're faced with conundrums that we have no idea about. We don't know what black, dark energy is, a dark matter. That seems like the more we know, the less we know. We're about where we should be in science. And here to talk about it is Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's an astrophysicist and a Frederick P. Rose director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also host of the new public television show Nova Science Now program. He is the new host of it, I should say. And he has a new book out. It's a collection of his essays called Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. And he joins us here in our New York studios. Always good to see you, Neil.
Yes, good to be back. Thanks for having me.
I have to give you credit for being way out in front on this Pluto thing. You banished Pluto from that, from the museum, from the Rose Hall there a long time ago.
And I got all the hate mail.
You did.
I have file cabinets full of letters from angry third graders, mm-hmm. completely disgruntled over what we had done, but our decision wasn't flippant.
Yeah,
it was the consequence of a lot of thinking and a lot of assessing of what direction the data were coming, and we were about to spend $200 million rebuilding the planetarium. You don't want to make a mistake in your exhibits upon
right.
doing so. No one else had the occasion to have to think that deeply about that subject at the time.
Right.
So we were out in front for that reason, but it's not as though we had different data available to us than others did.
Is the argument settled now? You think it's pretty much settled? Or?
Well, it depends what you mean by settled. What we did at the museum was not simply kick Pluto out of the solar system, as we were accused of doing. I felt like saying, yep, it was too small to make it in New York. they wanted me to say that, they wanted
right?
me to say that.
Yeah. Soundbite that they needed.
they were looking for that soundbite. And all we did was organize the contents of the solar system by like properties. So all the icy bodies in the outer solar system, including Pluto, we just grouped them together mm-hmm. as the Kuiper belt of comets. Mm-hmm. And the gas giants we put together and the rocky planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, they were together, and that was sort of the family photo of the solar system. We didn't count planets at all on the grounds that that's no longer an interesting scientific or pedagogical exercise.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your book, The Death by Black Hole. It's a collection of your essays. What made you choose certain essays and ones to leave out?
Oh, I chose the combination of essays that were my personal favorites
right.
that I felt best about
right.
and essays that were the most requested on my website.
Mm-hmm.
And people would ask, what did you write about this, the black hole, the center of the galaxy, the mm-hmm. beginning of the universe? And so it represents sort of the culmination of what has the greatest public, greatest cross-section to public appetite for the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the essays, the title essay, Death by Black Hole, was actually quite fun to write because I did it all the while knowing that people just love reading about death and destruction for some morbid fascination.
Watching that car wreck.
I don't. There's something about it. I don't know what, we need more psychologists to check on that one. And it starts from childhood where
right.
as a kid, all kids like dinosaurs, but what's their favorite dinosaur? It's T-Rex.
Right.
It's the one that can eat you.
Right.
And we have this tendency to fear and respect that which can eat us. And so a black hole has a lot of the same properties that T-Rex does, except for adults.
Mm-hmm. What would you say? I mentioned dark energy as being probably one of the great questions of our time. Would you say that is the biggest unknown now in the cosmos, or what would you call that?
I have a top three,
yes.
and I'd take them in any order.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the search for life in the universe beyond Earth.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know I want to know if in these exotic places that we now know exist in the solar system, the moons of Jupiter, the moons of Saturn, under the soils of Mars, where there's liquid water that recently was photographed oozing out from the side of a crater. I want to know. I want to go. I want to dig down and poke around, see if there's bacteria thriving under those exotic conditions. Mm-hmm. And that would be perhaps the most significant discovery in the world ever. Right. Forget categories of science. Just the most significant discovery of them all.
How should we get there to do that? Should we send people or should we send robots?
Well, we can do both. I'm a robot fan, but I happen to know that geologists like walking around with hammers in their hands, and mm-hmm. so. There'll be no shortage of geologists who want to make that trip. And there is an allure of having one of our own where you can live vicariously through their methods of questioning on any journey of exploration. Mm-hmm. So that's a very real intent. We saw it in the 60s and 70s with the Apollo era, and there's no reason why that couldn't be resurrected as another force to stimulate public sentiment for the space program.
All it takes is money, right?
That's all. Just money.
Just money. All right, let's go to number two.
Not in any order. Yeah. My top three. We still don't know what dark matter is. 85% of the gravity of the universe expresses itself by some means that is not traceable to electrons, protons, and neutrons, or any familiar form of matter mm-hmm. that we've ever studied. That's a conundrum that only recently got supplanted by an even bigger conundrum, that there's this mysterious pressure that we measure in the universe that's making us accelerate rather than just simply expand. We're not only expanding, we're accelerating in that expansion. We have these placeholder words for them. We call that one dark energy and the other one dark matter, but we don't know what they are.
Right.
They're enormous mysteries. And in your opening remarks, is science coming to an end? Doesn't look like it.
No,
doesn't look like it at all. No. In fact, it feels like we're getting stupider as we go along.
It does, doesn't it?
The questions are getting bigger that we don't know the answer to.
And number three? Was that number
three?
Oh,
those are the two. Dark matter, dark energy, and the search for life. I'd put those as... And that's not just me. You can poll 1,000 scientists. 900 of them will agree with that list.
You talk in your book about the loss of Carl Sagan as a spokesperson. I think a lot of people see you as the new Carl Sagan.
Well, I'm flattered by that comparison. I know I'm not unmindful that, you know, there's blood on the tracks there from his efforts to bring the frontier of science to the public. Mm-hmm. He did it at a time when that was not only not a supported activity in academic circles, it was a shunned activity. Why would you stoop to do such a thing? Why would you even deign to try to make any of this comprehensible? And so in a way, he shattered some of the priesthood that had surrounded mm-hmm. the enterprise of science. And I think it's only for the better. If for no other reason, that so much of astrophysics in particular is funded by tax-based sources through the National Science Foundation, through NASA, and it's your money. You ought to know what we're doing with your money. And if you don't like it, you ought to have a chance to tell us about it. Mm-hmm. But the evidence shows that the public eats it up. They love what's going on in our exploration of space. How many people have you met that have a Hubble telescope image sitting on their computer as their wallpaper or their backdrop or their screensaver? And the Mars rovers, they're getting, you know.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. It's all there.
Yeah.
And I don't twist media's arm to get interviewed when this happens. They're beating a path to my door. And so...
You're the gatekeeper. You're letting them in.
No, but I see it as not that they're after me. They see me as a way that they can further satisfy their hunger and their appetite for learning more about the cosmos. So it's real. Yeah. It's in us.
Do you think that your new hosting of Nova Science Now is your entree into this world?
With Nova Science Now, that as a kind of spinoff of Nova, there are fans of Nova out there who they get their hour of science, you know, each week. Nova Science Now is a slightly different format. The closest I can think of how to describe it is CBS's 60 Minutes, where there's segments of different nicely well-produced segments, interstitial material, and at the end, at least in 60 Minutes, there's Andy Rooney. You know, if Andy Rooney doesn't show up at the end of 60 Minutes, I feel cheated somehow. So I said for this.
So does he, actually.
So I said for this program, I gotta have a little spot at the end where it's just me and you and nothing else. And so I offer it.
Because they're going to tune in to see you, you know.
Well, perhaps.
And when all is said and done, they're tuning in to see you.
However, However, I have a rebuttal to that in a moment. But at the end, I offer what's called a cosmic perspective, where I sort of tie a bow on the science that you had just learned and put our place in the universe in context and in perspective as you might not have received it before. Mm-hmm. And that would be sort of the ending thoughts of each of the episodes. Now, to say whether they're tuning in to see me, I have evidence that that's not the case. And the evidence is I'm walking the streets. Strangers come up to me and say, oh, I saw you on the TV, and it's fine. Now, if I was the object of their interest, their next question would be, oh, could you sign this autograph for my kids? Or that's not what they ask.
No.
They don't care about autographs.
No.
They've got a whole list of questions they want to keep asking. And so they say, well, tell me about the black hole and the quasar and the gamma ray bursts and the global warming. And they see me as a continuing source of their access to understanding the universe. And as long as that's the case, I think I'm doing my job.
That's what used to happen to Carl Sagan also.
Yeah.
People would stop him on the street, and he'd take the time to talk to him.
Mm-hmm,
You know.
In fact, I've been late to many an appointment because I felt this sense of duty that if someone stops me in the street, I ought to give them some further cosmic insight.
Mm-hmm. So that's on the air now, and it's when could we see?
Oh, Tuesday night is the next episode.
It's on every Tuesday night?
No, not every Tuesday. It's still kind of in this sort of pilot phase. This year we made 5 episodes. Next year we hope to do 6, and we're sort of working up the numbers. But it runs in the same time slot as Nova does, which is Tuesday nights at 8:00 in most markets. But check your local listings, as they say.
That's as they say. I'm talking with Neil Tyson, author of Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. We're going to take a short break. Come back. Take your. A lot of people want to talk to Neil. I don't blame them. They're going to have questions for him that hopefully, you know, they're not going to ask him stuff like, you know, should I stop taking my medication like they ask other people. Keep it relevant. Stay with us. We'll be right back with your questions. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, here with Neil Tyson, author of Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries, a bunch of terrific essays that he's been compiling over the years. And what happens in Death by Black Hole? What happens to you when you fall into it? Well, you call it Death by Black Hole. What goes on in there?
I couldn't wait for you to ask. Well, first of all, it's a one-way trip. Let's just understand that, all right? This is not an experiment that you ever come back and tell your colleagues
about. Don't try this at home.
Okay. And so it turns out, on Earth, as you, of course, know, when you're standing up, your feet are closer to the center of the Earth than the top of your head is. And you can actually calculate what that means in terms of the force of gravity. The force of gravity is pulling a little more strongly on your feet than on your head. But you don't notice it because you're small compared with the size of the Earth. But if you take a feet-first dive towards a black hole, the difference in gravity between your feet and your head continues to grow. And so your feet will accelerate towards the center of a black hole faster than your head will. Now, for a little while, that'll just kind of feel good. You're stretching.
Sure.
But when that doesn't stop, what we have here is the envy of the Spanish Inquisition. This is a cosmic counterpart to the stretching machine. Cosmic rack, exactly. And so what happens is the difference in gravity, it's actually officially called the tidal force.
Mm-hmm.
It's a variant on tides, actually, that's going on in your body. Basically, when that tidal force exceeds the intermolecular forces of your tissue, of your physical biological tissue, then the tissue splits apart and you snap into 2 seconds.
I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. And so you first snap into 2 segments. Your lower half leaves your upper half. And then this process continues to grow. And the 2 halves that are on their way in, they then feel this effect. And they split. They snap into 2 parts each. So you go from 1 whole body to 2 pieces to 4 to 8 to 16. So you bifurcate your way down to the center of the black hole. Meanwhile, the very fabric of space and time in the vicinity of a black hole becomes funneled. So you are actually while you are stretching, you're becoming extruded like toothpaste through a tube through the fabric of space and time. And in fact, there's even a word for this. This is what's so cool about it. It's called spaghettification.
Spaghettification.
This is what will happen to you. You'll become spaghettified. And as you descend towards the singularity that's the center of the black hole, you'll be just the stream of atoms.
Wow.
And basically, that's the end of your experiment.
Will time have stopped for you?
Yes, but for everyone, this is what someone will see as they watch you fall in.
But for you, you won't know this is happening. Time will have stopped, and you'll be spaghettified. And
well, no, sorry. I said that backwards. Mm-hmm. We on the horizon, outside of the horizon, will watch you slow down, and we'll watch time stop for you. But for you, no, you just fall in. Mm-hmm. I mean, millions of years go by outside. Billions of years will go by. And we'll get bored watching you sort of frozen. In fact, there was a book written 30 years ago called Frozen Star, which is referring to how the relativistic phenomenon, as described by Einstein, freezes things right outside the horizon of the black hole. But if you're the one falling in, it just happens very quickly. Wow. So it's a fast, easy death. And that's how I'd want to go
absolutely.
If you got to go.
Absolutely.
Do it that way.
Let's go to James in San Antonio, speaking of going. Hi, James. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you so much for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask Neil with his insight. I'm 23 years old, and I love Star Trek and 2001 and all of that. I was never that good at algebra, calculus, physics, that stuff. I was wondering what the likelihood of me in my lifetime being able to charter like a slingshot around the moon flight for, you know, 10 or 12 grand, if that's anywhere within the realm of possibility in his opinion.
For 10 or 12 grand? That's, you know, you're pushing it there. Maybe 10 or 12 million, but okay. I don't see 10 or 12 grand in the immediate future or even in the foreseeable future. That sounds awfully cheap to me.
So like a space flight like we saw in 2001 where he's a stewardess is attending to him with the Velcro shoes, I'll probably be long dead before that becomes a reality then.
No. Well, he was just going to orbit for that. Oh, yeah. And he did go to the moon after he walked around in orbit. Maybe you can get to the orbit for a few grand. But if you want to go beyond that, I mean, these are major, major hunks of hardware enabling this kind of transportation. I mean, you can't go on a round-the-world cruise for 12,000. So you want to go to the moon for that? So I'd start saving.
So maybe I'll be able to be weightless in orbit on my, like, 90th birthday then.
Sure. Yeah, and by the way, you don't even need to go to an orbit to be weightless.
You can go
in a tall elevator shaft and cut the cable. that's another one of those one-way trips.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Nice roller coaster. Okay.
Yeah.
1-800-989-8255. You know, people love to talk about this. You know, this is such still an
access
interesting
to
topic.
Space.
Access to space is...
And what will probably drive it in the future, unlike the Apollo era where there was sort of military subtext for our trying to beat the Russians, what may be the greatest driver in the future is the simple economics of tourism. Mm. The interest, just like your caller mentioned, of, you know, whatever you'd pay to go to the most expensive theme park in the world, you'd pay more than that to go into orbit. And so, and there's a continuum of people's capacity to pay for entertainment. And so, as we already know, there are people shelling out $20 million to go to orbit on the Russian Soyuz.
Yeah.
So that's just the beginning.
Luke in Little Rock, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, how you guys doing? Listen, forget about the trip to the moon. I still want my jet backpack.
Me too. And the flying bubble cars. I want that too.
Hey, listen, great show. I appreciate you having me on. And listen, I grew up reading Carl Sagan books, and I'm kind of an amateur astronomer. I have my telescope and take my 5-year-old out and 4-year-old out, and we look at the moon and stuff. But, you know, and I'm all for spending money for the space program. And I want to wonder, I'm sure you probably get people that ask you this question, with so much poverty and war and famine, you know, how do you justify to people who ask you, you know, we have so many problems here on Earth, why should we go and spend money out in space? I mean, I know that there are a lot of problems are being solved by, you know, technology and things like that, but do people ask you that question often, and how do you respond to that?
I get it all the time, and I'll try to give sort of a Reader's Digest version of it, because the full exposition would take me more time than we have right now. But let me just tell you simply, in every case where someone makes that point, why are we spending billions up there when we should be spending it down here? My next question to them is, well, how much of your tax dollar do you think we're actually spending in space? So I hold up the dollar, and I say, how much? Here's a dollar you pay in tax. How much do you think we're spending? And the answer is invariably 10 cents, 20 cents, 30 cents on the dollar. And then I tell them that it's 7/10 of one penny that has paid for the shuttles, the space station, all the Hubble repair missions, the rovers, all the images you get back from space, the measurements of the early universe, 0.7. We're a wealthy nation. So the question is, not do you put all the money to solve poverty? The question is, what do you do with all the money that you have? Is knowing about our place in the universe worth 0.7 on a tax dollar to you? If it's not, well, we're a democracy, you have the right to vote that. But I can tell you this, that there are countries who don't have such ambitions, countries who don't explore, who, when you visit them, the culture is kind of absent this perspective that we all take for granted here. We're all thinking about the future all the time. And we just think that's a natural way to think. It's not natural. Most places in the world don't have that luxury. And I don't want to live in a country where nobody's thinking about the future, because I value that too much. And our future is...
Obviously, the perspective that you're giving us, I mean, the way that you frame things is just really spectacular. I think that you're giving a great framework to make people think about those things. And I just want to say I appreciate you forcing me to keep looking up at the sky, and I'll keep doing that for my four-year-old, and hopefully years from now he'll be reading your books and learning about space and exploration from you. I think you do a great job being a spokesperson for people who are interested in this. And I think you have
I would hope that I'm not never forcing you to look up. I'd hope that I'm simply encouraging you to look up.
You're not actually pulling my head, head back, but I do appreciate your words of wisdom, and it kind of keeps me always looking beyond myself and beyond things bigger than me.
That's an important way to live, as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. One of the things I saw on the Nova Science Now programs is one of my favorite topics is the space elevator.
Space elevator.
It's possible, actually. I mean, to put an elevator, park it in orbit, and go up and down a ribbon that stretches?
There is no law of physics that prevents it. But we're still very far away from it from an engineering standpoint. The space elevator, if any of your listeners are not otherwise familiar, is imagined as an extremely cheap way to get to Earth orbit. Because as you may know, our communication satellites orbit at such a distance that their time to orbit Earth exactly equals the time that Earth rotates, so that these satellites appear to hover over any one spot on the Earth, depending on where you want to park it. Well, imagine a platform sitting there, and then you kind of lower down a hose, kind of like Jack and the Beanstalk, but in reverse. And as you do this, you just anchor the rope or the ribbon to some place on Earth's surface, and then you take an elevator up to orbit. This has the potential to be vastly cheaper than the current ways and means by which we get to orbit. Maybe as cheap as your caller had suggested for $12,000. And so one of the segments in the upcoming Nova Science Now is we go to the XPRIZE contest, which took place in New Mexico just a couple of months ago. And there was a contest for who can design a prototype space elevator that went up about 250 feet, not the 23,000 miles it will ultimately need to reach. And so you need new materials. No known material that we now currently use, commonly use, will work for this. You'd have to figure out a way to use carbon nanotubes as your hoist.
Right. This is an Arthur C. Clarke. Didn't he originally come up with this idea?
Yeah, I don't know if he invented the space elevator concept. He certainly was the first to come out with the geosynchronous orbit concept, knowing immediately how valuable that would be for communications between continents.
Yeah. He wrote.
But he wrote extensively on it. He popularized it.
Did he write 2001: Space Odyssey also?
Oh yeah. It was a collaboration with Stanley Kubrick as well.
Yeah. But what is so interesting about that film is that about how they went to Jupiter and the outer planets, knowing that's where to look for life or life might come from. And we keep hearing about the moons of Saturn this week, of Titan, having, these methane pools. Shouldn't we be going out there looking for primordial life?
You make an excellent point. In fact, most of the 20th century, we're all imagining that, the planets are the place to go, and these satellites are just these dead rocks, like our moon is this kind of dead place, geologically dead at least, and certainly has got no life. And so... So what we learned by these, as Voyager went past, and is that the moons are where the action is. The moons are where, you know, no two moons are the same. And so there's no end of ways to think about what's going on there. Is there a heat source? What has become liquefied if not water? And on Saturn's moon Titan, it's just been learned that there it is cold enough and the atmospheric pressure is just right that the gas that comes out of most people's gas stoves, methane, has liquefied on its surface, and it makes rivers and lake beds and, I mean, lakes sitting in lake beds and coastlines. So there's a whole geology of Saturn's moon Titan brought to you by liquefied methane, something that we've only ever experienced in gaseous form in a household, in your household environment.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson, author of Death by Black Hole and Other Cosmic Quandaries, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. But it seems like there's just so much money to do everything, I mean, at least in NASA's budget. And they have chosen to take Return to the Moon and going back to Mars and take some of the money that might go to these other space probes away.
Yeah, that's an important point of contention in the scientific community. You know, many people who wear the pure scientist hat would say, don't ever send people. Well, why not? Well, because people usually want to come back, or they want to eat. Whereas mm-hmm. a robot, you don't have to feed. Just give it a couple of solar panels. It's happy. And you could leave it in situ when you're done.
Right.
And so the cost of sending people is at least a factor of 10, and in some cases a factor of 100 more costly than sending a robot. And so that brings in the question, why are we going into space? Is it for purely scientific reason? The answer is just simply no. We didn't go to the moon for purely scientific reasons. There were other drivers. There were political drivers. There were economic drivers. There were security drivers. And so we just need to be honest with ourselves about these other drivers that influence how NASA spends its money. Yes, we can try to fight it, but I think it's kind of pointless. When the manned program has been healthy in the history of NASA, so too has been the science portfolio. Mm-hmm. So I think I have to agree, it's high time that NASA got its manned program back on the map. Instead of just simply boldly going where hundreds have gone before, we've spent 30 years just driving around in low Earth orbit, going mm-hmm. nowhere fast.
Yeah.
It's time that there were some new headlines made by the manned program.
Well, we have headlines made by other countries now, like China says that they're going to the moon.
Well, that's kind of the flame that's sitting under our buttocks right now when you see that everyone else values this enterprise enough to make them national priorities, and we're just sitting around saying, oh, yeah, we did already. Let's think of something else to do. And so it's a reassessment of our self-image. You know, what do we bring the world? We brought him Disney and the moon landing and computers. All right, these are...
And Disney brought us the moon landing first.
That's true,
in
actually.
The 50s.
They did. I saw the tapes.
I remember watching that as a kid.
Right.
Then, you know, that's how we were going to the
moon. That's part of dreaming about the future, by the way. Nobody else made that video. We made that video. Americans mm-hmm. made that video. So it's... I should be careful about that. Of course, the birth of our space program was traceable to Wernher von Braun and
whole
set of German engineers.
Right.
But we had the vision and the money to want to do it, and we did it.
So you sit on an advisory council for NASA,
yes, well,
right?
Yeah, I was a three-time sort of appointee in this regard. One of them was the commission that advised Congress and the White mm-hmm. House on how to implement this vision for space exploration. And now I serve on the advisory council for NASA. It's called the NAC. It's kind of like a board, except the emphasis on the A in the NAC is advisory.
Do they actually listen to anything?
Eventually.
I've been on a lot of advisory councils, you know. We see, and well, now we see big commissions that come up with reports and no one listens to them anyhow.
Yeah, there's always that. Occasionally, they'll still do what they want.
Right.
But what you know will happen is if you don't give them any advice at all, they'll only ever do just what they want and not what perhaps might be in the best interest of a broader community. So I'd rather keep up the fight than give it up.
Do you think that the private sector is going to take over?
It's going to have to if we want to convert a space program into a space industry where it's then self-supporting by its own investments. And because it is an expensive enterprise, and if you want to do it forever into the future, it's going to require that kind of that kind of interest. And we see some of that already with these private enterprises that are trying to launch their own rockets.
Why don't we just hire Burt Rutan and these people to do it for us instead of, you know?
Well, that may ultimately come. Their spacecraft are still a bit rudimentary right now. They're not going sideways in their velocities, which is what you need to do to go into orbit. You have to go sideways 18,000 miles an hour. What they're doing is going up, a few miles and, 50 miles, 60 miles. So you're above enough of the atmosphere you can see stars in the daytime sky. And that's a nice checkpoint. And I don't have a problem with that. That's the same kind of checkpoint that the Wright brothers were put through when they just sort of flew the length of their field.
Sure. Well, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Neil deGrasse Tyson, author of Death by Black Hole. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking with Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, director of the Hayden Planetarium. His new book, excellent book, is called Death by Black Hole, subtitled And Other Cosmic Quandaries. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get one more call in before we have to say goodbye. Anna in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Hi, Anna.
Hi. I've just been having this probing question for a long time now. How did scientists prove that what the life cycle of star was?
Ooh, excellent question.
I told you we have these smart people out
there.
Man,
you know why that's not a widely known concept is because it took decades to figure that out. There was no lone scientist burning the midnight oil that then had a biographer to tell what they figured out. It was hundreds of scientists. Particle physics labs, a lot of creative people, computer models of what's going on inside a star. But to shorten the explanation, it really came down to the fact that we have an enormous sample to look at. At any given moment, you can take a snapshot of the galaxy, and you have thousands, millions of stars, all at different stages of their lives. And if you can't follow a single star through its life, the next best thing is to get as many stars in your sample as possible. You'll catch some being born, some in the middle of their lives, and some in the act of dying. Mm-hmm. And it's a tremendous puzzle to put them together in an order that makes sense and is consistent with the data. But it took decades. And now it's one of the triumphs of 20th century astrophysics.
You talk about this a lot in your book, and you talk about the people standing on each other's shoulders and how science depends on other scientists. In your mind, I hate to give you the one person question, but who stands out in your mind as the greatest astronomer or the greatest contribution in the 20th century?
Oh, there's no question. Isaac Newton. Oh, there's no question.
In the 20th century.
Oh, 20th century. Oh, Einstein. Einstein. No question. Mm-hmm. But I'd still put Isaac Newton above Einstein.
You would.
And I know we got Einstein fans out there that would like that will get into a fight.
But I'm thinking about somebody like Hubble or somebody who discovered that the universe is expanding and all that kind of
stuff. Oh, yeah, but he had the biggest telescope in the land. So like, you also have to ask the right questions and know you have to have a nose for what for where the fertile areas of the universe remain to be discovered. But he simply had access to the biggest telescope of the day. It was the 100-inch Hooker telescope, which still exists and is actually still used now for educational mm-hmm. projects in mm-hmm. California. Mm-hmm. But there's an important transition that's happened even just recently in the sciences. I want to try to make this point, and we try to celebrate this a bit in the program Nova Science Now. The questions of origins, when you ask what is the origin of the planets, what is the origin of life, what is the origin of the universe, it tends to cross-pollinate sciences that previously had not much of an occasion to speak with one another. So when we search for life on Mars, well, you need the astrophysicist to know how to get there. You need the geologist to know what the soils are like, the rock structures are like. You might need the chemist to know whether the chemistry of the soil can support life itself. And so these origins questions are creating a cross-pollination of the sciences as never before. And it's an extraordinary renaissance in and as a result, all sciences are benefiting. There's like these tide waters that are rising beneath them all. And in Nova Science Now, each of the segments is drawn from a different branch of science. And what we try to do is make it clear to the viewer, and in my book, clear to the reader, that you are surrounded by science. Science is not just some otherworldly thing you learned about in your class in high school that you can just sort of forget by choice. It is you are steeped in the operations of the universe, be they biological, chemical, physical, astrophysical, geological. And it manifests itself in the global warming, whether they're going to be hit by an asteroid. What is the stability of life under all these conditions? Is there life in the universe? What is our place in the universe? And so I'd like to think that in the coming decades, there'll be a renaissance in the public appreciation and the public appetite for the science that they receive.
We can only hope so. Thank you, Neil, for taking time to be with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He's also the host of the public TV show Nova Science Now, and his new book is called Death by Black Hole. It's a great read. I recommend you all pick up a copy.